Garcia, the director of the CSFI. And today I have the pleasure of having with me Natalie Schoen, who is an expert in Islamic finance. Natalie, can you tell us a little bit more about you?
So I got into Islamic finance many years ago when I was working in the Middle East. And I just found it really fascinating as an idea, especially because there's a specific link to Islam and everything else. And we don't really do that in other religions, which made me wonder what was so special about this. And then I've worked for an Islamic bank for a while. And although I do other things in finance as well, it's one of the things that I actually am quite fascinated by.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the fascinating things. I mean, we all have learning history, then, Catholicism, Christians also forbid usury and raising interest rates. But they seem to have overcome that obstacle. Well, in Islam, they seem to have codified it. Can you speak to us a little bit about how the different religions have tackled that problem or that issue?
It's very interesting because if you look back, so the first codified law that we know about is the Hammurabi Code, which is like 1600 BC. No, it's more than 2000. It's more than 4000 years ago. I mean, somewhere around that. And it has things in it that prohibit the charging of money for money, even though, you know, the concept of money was different at the time. And then if we scroll through history really, really quickly, then we see that in different societies, like the ancient Romans didn't like interest either. But then they started looking at it slightly differently and thought, well, maybe we should just set like a level that you can have. And they had these very interesting distinctions, like you can charge so much for the poor people and you can charge less for a nobleman or somebody who is of a nobler standing, and you can charge so much for this type and so much for seafaring. And that included that was a higher rate because there was a higher risk. If we look at other religions as well, we see there is definitely a prohibition on interest, and a lot of it has to do with the unfairness in society that's created by what's known as compound interest, so the interest on top of interest.
So it's not the interest, but the compound interest.
It's the compounding that's always caused the significant social indifference and still does. I mean, if we look at who receives most of the interest, 20% of people received 80% of the interest, but 20% of people also pay 80% of the interest. So and you see that with things like payday loans and credit card interest, for example. I mean, you know, you buy on your credit card or you use a payday loan, and the amount you have to pay, even though the minimum amount is only like £5 maybe, but it adds up really fast. There's a couple of things that made it change. And I think one of the main ones is that companies needed money. Traders needed money, and they didn't always have it. And there is only so much anyone who lends money wants to go with giving that at high risk, right? Because if I invest, it's high risk. And then we started to see things like people started playing around with things like foreign exchange transactions. So there was the first foreign exchange transaction was two brothers in Genoa. And they did a lot of business with the Ottoman Empire at the time. And what they did is they had a forward rate agreed, which was significantly higher than the actual rate was supposed to be. And that was to cover the interest. And they made the exchange in that way. Then we see companies becoming larger and larger, needing more and more money. And equally, they want the certainty of having to pay back a certain amount rather than a changing, an ever-changing amount. And from there, it became more and more required to have something in place where there was some form of mitigation or arbitration between these parties. So the one party that has money and doesn't necessarily know what to do with it, and the party that doesn't have any money but has brilliant idea. And there was then also the recognition of capital is costing money, right? It's not free. And that all resulted in the current banking system as we know it. And I think it's interesting to mention here that the UK had an anti-usury law until the late 1700s. Every single state in the United States of America still has an anti-usury law.
Wow.
Now, some of them state there is not, you know, there's no minimum or no maximum that can be charged. Some of them have a maximum and say you cannot charge more than 8% unless, and then they have a whole list of exemptions, unless you are a payday loan company, unless it's agreed differently between the parties, unless you're a casino, unless you're a credit card company. So everyone who wants to charge more just can, really.
So unless you want to.
Unless you wish to, then you can always find a loophole.
Yeah. So why didn't the same happen in Islam? And what was their solution? What is the solution according to the Sharia?
So why that hasn't happened, I mean, I'm not sure whether it's not going to happen going forward, because it may. I mean, you know, that there may be. One of the reasons why it hasn't happened is because a lot of companies that come out of, the Middle Eastern or Muslim dominated countries, is they are still fairly relatively small. I mean, I don't mean small, but they are still controlled by single families. They may have some outside shareholding going on, but not necessarily an awful lot. Although that is changing, and we do see that changing. A lot of these countries also apply English law, so there is obviously that. So what happened is that instead of actually saying, well, I charge you interest, you charge something else. And it's important to understand that there's still no compounding. So if I have a Murabaha transaction, for example, which
is... What does that mean?
So it means that if I own something,
yeah,
and I sell it to you, and I sell it to you for the original price I paid plus a profit.
Okay.
So technically, if you go to a bookstore, right?
Yeah.
And you buy a book, that's a Murabaha transaction. It's a trade transaction.
Okay.
Now, if you go to a bookstore, you pay there and then. And if you actually need to borrow money in a way, because you can't pay for it right now because you need a larger quantity of goods and you need to sell those, for example, or do some manufacturing, you can agree with the person who sells it to you that you pay for it later. However, that's the end of it. So you cannot then extend it. You cannot charge more if they don't pay on time. It has to be paid there and at that point in time.
Okay.
So that's one way. Another way is to the introduction of leasing transactions.
Mm-hmm.
Leasing is very popular. Mm-hmm. And then there's the partnerships, which is more like an investment style transaction, so an equity style transaction. Now there's others, but the idea is the same, right? You charge either a markup or a profit share or a profit or a rental, but you charge something that's associated with either the asset or the enterprise.
Okay. And can you differentiate according to the risk profile of the
other party,
commas, lender?
You can. So you can actually introduce, because one of the statements that's made is profit is for those who share the risk. Well, profit is for those who take the risk. So the more risk I take, the more I could potentially charge. And in a leasing transaction, I can even increase the lease amount depending on what the risk is. And same for a Murabaha transaction we just talked about. I can increase the profit because it's up to me how much I want to charge. I can also take things like collateral and guarantees.
Okay. And so normally we associate Islamic finance with a more ethical approach to finance. Hmm? But at the same time, it's not very clear if it's cheaper or not. Yes, I'm thinking of yesterday, The Guardian had an article on how it's more expensive to get a mortgage in the UK than is Sharia compliant than one than it isn't. So how is that ethical? Why do we think of why is it more expensive if it's there is no interest?
Well, number one, banks still need to make money, right? Because even if there's no interest, it doesn't mean that there's no profit, right? These are two different, distinctly different things. I think so. Banks tend to justify that in a number of ways, and one of the things is it's more expensive to operate because you have your Sharia advisory board, you have to have these different structures, you have additional lawyers' fees. All these things add up to the cost, and these costs are passed on to the customer. I used to work for an Islamic bank, and their viewpoint was it should not be more expensive than anything else. It should, for a comparable service, it should cost the same. Which,
It.
well, I mean, so specific, the interesting comparison was the leases, because leases you can actually quite quickly see whether your pricing is right. And it was on the basis that we won some, we lost some, but we did win quite a few. So therefore, the pricing was about right. You always lose some, right? But I mean, the mortgages in itself is an interesting one because it used to be much easier to find out what the Islamic banks were charging for mortgages. It's much harder these days. But the difference is about 150 to 200 basis points compared to, for example, an HSBC, which is quite a lot of money. And I mean, this is not like a lender who's trying to, I mean, I'm not comparing it with any lender that's trying to, cut their rates to get more business. This is a reputable lender in its own right. And it's problematic because people can't necessarily afford to pay extra.
No, and I mean you're writing about it, and we have the honor of publishing your paper very soon. And you write about this point, and the markets in general and policymakers were expecting Islamic finance to really develop very fast a few years ago, and then this expansion hasn't really taken place. And could you explain to us what are the constraints that the sector is facing?
That's a really good question. So firstly, there is of course the cost. I mean, research by one of the bigger consultancies quite a few years ago showed that there's only 15% of people really who's willing to pay more for something that aligns with their belief system. And if you look at, for example, think the companies like Toyota's bank, they, I mean, they've taken decades to actually become profitable. And they're very ESG oriented. I mean, they're doing really well right now because there's a renewed interest in these areas, but it definitely has taken them a very good while to get to that significant mass. Now, one of the reasons why the cost is higher is because there are fewer customers, technically. And part of that is not because there's no demand. There is definitely demand, but there are 6 million Muslims in the UK on the most recent, there or thereabouts, on the most recent census. They are spread out around the country, which makes it hard to actually have a bank in a central location so you can access all these 6 million customers. They follow different schools of thoughts who have differences of opinion about what's acceptable and what is not. So that makes it rather a challenging situation to cater for these customers. And then on top of that, they not all of them, and most of them are moving away from that, but they all used to have the name, the word Islamic in the name, or very often have the word Islamic. They have products that are identified by Arabic names that nobody really understands. But a lot of people think it's not for them. Whereas, you know, all the principles underlying it, like honesty, transparency, fairness, clarity, honesty in doing business, all these things align much more with the whole ESG idea. And yes, could technically be much more interesting for a much larger population.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is that at first sight, it looks like it could be really aligned, at least, or it could be more easily made to align with a lot more, a lot of the ESG concerns, because very often you are transferring the assets, for example, and not just the money. Yeah? And so you know where you are investing by definition. Huh? And so you could, choose more. It's a bit like a green bond in my head. Maybe I'm totally wrong, but like I think of Sukuks having a quite a similar structure sometimes than green bonds.
Yeah, definitely more on the social and governance part. The green part, I mean, you know, a lot of them are issued out of oil producing countries, so you know we can argue about that till the cows come home. But yeah. But it definitely has much more alignment with that sort of work, and you can also see it in if you compare it with, for example, the credit unions and the building societies. Yeah. They don't make excessive amounts of profits, but equally they never make excessive amounts of crazy losses either. I mean, building societies fared the crisis fairly well.
In terms of global capitals, I mean, you mentioned the difference of opinions, of standards. I think that's really quite fascinating how we don't think about that. And, you know, Sharia compliant might not, you know, not everybody might assess Sharia compliance in the same way.
Yeah, and it's challenging because there are a number of majority school. I mean, there's a number of majority school of thought. There's obviously the distinction between the Sunni and the Shia, and then there's underneath that there's different schools of thought, and they all have different opinions. And then individual scholars can have even further, slightly more or less diverging opinions. And that leads to a situation where, in the absence of standardization in the market, not for want of trying, mind, but in the absence of full standardization or more standardization, there's always the argument between Bank A and Bank B. Whereas Bank A says, oh, this is not compliant. This is my compliant transaction. Bank B said, not really sure. And then the only people who make money out of that are the lawyers in the end, because, you know, they get to rewrite everything. And they still, I mean, they don't get paid by the word anymore, but, you know, they're still quite expensive.
Well, that's a commonality across all forms of finance.
Yes, but if you have high levels of standardization, like we're used to in the more conventional markets, then that is less so. I mean, so, you know, a current account is a current account is a current account, right? A loan is a loan is a loan. Yeah, a loan between banks, there is never going to be any argument about what the exact minutia of the conditions is. Whereas with a murabaha as a depositor loan, there will be, or there often is.
No, I'm sure that uncertainty must be quite a big barrier. How large do you think the sector is in its totality, more or less? And how do you think it could grow? If you think that would be a good idea to expand
this? I think one of the things that always strikes me is how a lot of the Islamic financial institutions are really keen to become much bigger than they are. I mean, there have been talk about mega banks being set up. It never happened, but, well, you know, can come. There's been talk about, you know, these large, they really want the Shells of this world as their customers and the Unilevers. And you know, Shell and Unilever are too big for a small bank. It's never going to happen. One of the banks I used to work for, which is a quite a long time ago, they merged into one because they both wanted Shell as their customer. And Shell said, look, I only want one bank to deal with. Sort yourselves out and we'll talk. And they merged and they got them as a client. But, you know, this was already slightly a larger bank than most of the Islamic financial institutions are right now. I think the big growth potential for Islamic financial institutions lies in the local market. Okay. Because there's also less issues with Sharia compliance, right? If I finance my local shop or my a company that's near me that's servicing my regional or even national area, there is a lot less discrepancy in Sharia compliance because it's the same country and it has a predominant school of thought. So there's less discussion about that. It's also building that client base, mm-hmm. because that's the only way you get all these larger companies that you eventually might want to get interested in actually doing business with you, because you've got to show what you can do. There's a much closer relationship with customers. It is easier to have alignment in your ESG factors. And I think that's a position of growth. Okay. It's not as exciting, though.
Well, if that's similar, I mean, hearing you, it reminds me of HSBC. You mentioned HSBC before and the global kind of strategy. Do you think that's the kind of thing you have in mind? Would that be a fair description?
That's an interesting comparison. It's interesting for a number of reasons. Number one, because they're really priding themselves on being the local bank. I mean, they've had their ups and downs. I mean, they do have their challenges, but they are really priding themselves on being local. As in, you know, we work here for you rather than just working for larger customers. It's also the whole of the industry estimated size is probably somewhere in the region of the size of HSBC. So that's an interesting comparison as well. And then it might actually be an idea to just build a network of these local banks so they can support each other. They can invest in each other's areas. They have a challenge with liquidity. Most of the Islamic financial institutions have too much money and no place to go with it. So that might be an idea as well.
Well, thank you very much, Natalie. It's a fascinating subject. Thank you.